Good morning. Please be seated. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bolla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today in Las Vegas is Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the time and date set for oral argument in case number 88961, Washington versus Orange Realty Group. At council table in Las Vegas, we have, I believe, Emily McFarlane and Julie Bravo Bizard on behalf of appellants. It's my understanding that Ms. Bravo Bizard, you will be doing the opening, and Ms. McFarlane, you will do rebuttal. Is that correct? Okay. And we also have Matthew Johnson here on behalf of respondents. And no one is with you at council table, so I will move on. Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Ms. Bravo Bizard, how much time would you all like to reserve for rebuttal? 3 minutes? Very good. You can proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Julie Bravo Bizard, representing Venice and Ariel Washington, the appellants. I am a recent graduate of Boyd Law, and so I am practicing under student license per NSCR 49.3. I'd like to reserve, as I said, 3 minutes for rebuttal. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to begin by thanking Venice Washington. It is her hard work and dedication to righting this wrong that has given us not only the opportunity to talk about her case, but to shed some light on an injustice that I believe many Nevada tenants are suffering. So just briefly as a roadmap, I'm going to start with some context to frame the argument and then go into the basis for the two errors that we believe were made by the district court, including improper application of the preclusion doctrine and improper dismissal without review of the evidence. So just briefly, I'd like to clarify that although I started talking about Venice, this case is not really about her and what she did or did not do. It's not about whether or not she paid the rent. It's not about whether or not she followed all the procedural rules to a T. Today's appeal isn't even about what we believe is the respondent's dishonesty on the original eviction complaint. It's not about them wrongfully subjecting Venice and Ariel to 12 months of the fear and embarrassment of homelessness. And it's not really about the fact that they are continuing to deny the essential facts of the case despite irrefutable evidence to the contrary. Instead, today we're going to focus largely on the court's part in enabling this injustice, because at its core, today's appeal is about the landlord-friendly bias that is deeply ingrained in Nevada's summary eviction process. And we'll talk about how this persistent bias so poisons the well against Nevada tenants that landlords and property managers can deceive the court with apparent impunity. And left unchecked, this bias makes the court complicit in enabling the wrongful upheaval of the lives of honest people like the Washingtons. Because in a sense, Venice has been a canary in a coal mine that's warning of a great danger to Nevada tenants. It's a cautionary tale about the court's frequently callous disregard for tenants. And her nightmare shows us that the courts will not even protect hardworking middle-class Nevadans if they appear on the wrong side of the V in an eviction action. Anybody who's observed summary eviction in the Las Vegas Justice Courts knows that there's a great power imbalance. Frequently, the landlord's agent will stand up and accuse the tenant of not paying rent. The tenant, who is often either elderly, disabled, or most often a single mom of color, will offer respectful, apologetic explanation, and then the court quickly orders summary eviction, rinse and repeat. And this is the best case scenario, assuming that the tenant actually knew that there was going to be a hearing and was able to appear, unlike Denise, who did not even know that there was a hearing, and only found out about the summary eviction when she got the 24-hour lockout notice posted on her door. Clearly there is potential for abuse in this process, because not many tenants, once their lives have been thrown into this kind of chaos, will immediately explore their legal remedies. So courts really should listen to the exceptional tenant who takes these steps instead of merely shooing them away and assuming that the summary eviction process provided sufficient opportunity to be heard. So just to simplify references to the procedural history, rather than talk about five cases, I'd like to refer to the procedural history as three distinct phases, phase one being the eviction and the subsequent appeal, phase two being the small claims, and phase three being the district court that brings us here today. So, appellants contend that Judge Albertson erred in two ways in that phase three. As I said, the application of the preclusion doctrine was improper because the essential issue underlying the plaintiff's claims had never been decided on the merits, and the dismissal without consideration of evidence was improper as genuine factual disputes remained. So in regards to the decided on the merits, NRS 40.2536 states the issuance of summary order for removal of the tenant does not preclude an action by the tenant for any damages or other relief to which the tenant may be entitled. Clearly, Nevada legislators knew that summary eviction proceedings before a hearing master is not a reasonable forum to have damage claims actually litigated. The pace of the proceedings do not enable tenants to prepare a proper case, and hearing masters do not have the authority to decide such claims. And the entire process is designed to speed up and simplify the eviction process for landlords. Therefore, tenants must be given a separate opportunity to pursue remedies, as any remedies for any steamrolling or other wrongdoing which may have occurred.
Ms. Bravo-Bizard, let me just ask you a quick question. Let's say we agree with you and that statute allowed the Washingtons to file a damages claim after their summary eviction. Didn't they do that in the small claims court?
They did. Unfortunately, as we said, the reason behind the statute is that they want to ensure that the tenants have an adequate chance to have their claims actually litigated. And while she was able to present evidence, ultimately the order dismissing was simply based on, on the preclusion doctrine and stating that the eviction court took care of that.
But isn't that a decision on the merits, a final decision on the merits?
Whether or not, I would say that it was not, because if you actually look at the record of the eviction court and the subsequent appeals, she was never able to present her arguments. And so the dismissal from small claims never decided, what really happened. There were still genuine, there were disputes of material facts at that point.
Couldn't she have appealed from that decision, the small claims court decision, or did she appeal from that decision?
She theoretically could have. Knowing her situation, I understand why she didn't. Both because, you have to appeal that, I think, within 5 days, and you have to post a bond. At that point, she had been homeless for 6 months. And had received twice, had been told that, this was all decided by the eviction court. So a sense of depression and hopelessness had come in at that time. Also, she, you know, just like the judges, she was not aware of this statute that we uncovered. So to come up with an argument against preclusion within 5 days, you know, to have any idea that she had any kind of a chance, is probably not realistic. If we would argue as well that if that was an issue, she would only be precluded from the $10,000 of damages that she sought in that action. And clearly a year's worth of homelessness is worth a lot more than that. So at the most, this action could only preclude $10,000 of the damages accrued.
Why do you believe that it could only, overlap with the $10,000? Is that related to the jurisdictional limit?
Yes.
Didn't G.C. Wallace actually reject the argument that jurisdictional limits in small claims court actions prevent a claim from being brought?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
G.C. Wallace, the argument, they say it's well settled that a jurisdictional limit alone does not, for purposes of claim preclusion, prevent a claim from being brought. So couldn't your clients effectively have brought their damages claims in that forum and then experience claim preclusion as a result?
I do not believe that she brought all of the same claims that she later brought in the district court. I'm not sure whether or not in that forum they would have been limited. So I'm going to ask my attorney McFarling to address that.
So I just want to make sure that I understand. Is there any claim that was brought in the district court action, which is the order that's being appealed to mm-hmm. us, that could not have been brought in the small claims action?
Again, I apologize, Your Honor. I am.
That's what Ms. Not McFarling will address.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Are any of the Washington's damages claims in the district court action unrelated to the eviction?
They are all related to the effects of the eviction, absolutely. In the beginning of this whole case, she, you know, tried filing several motions to have it rescinded, to have it sealed. Her asks were very modest. As time went on and they continued to deny what she knew to be true, and she had more of an opportunity. I know that, again, this is a factual issue, but I know that she had, by the time she filed in the district court, she had finally found a place to live, which enabled her the peace of mind to do some more legal research and look at her options at that point. So we just also would like to say that we believe that it was an error that Judge Albertson dismissed without reviewing any of the evidence. The page 381 of the record of appeal that was first sent over by the district court included absolute proof of her contentions. I believe that this is information that she struggled to get from CHAPS because they had been so far behind. But they proved that they were receiving CHAP funds, which was government subsidized, for the benefit of both tenants and landlords, and that the eviction proceedings had commenced prior to 60 days, and that she had suffered 2.5 years of them denying what is obviously true from this document. So I would just like to say very briefly that the CHAP funds were meant to benefit, as I said, tenants and landlords, and unfortunately, they did not do their part by waiting the 60 days before starting any eviction proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Morning, Judge Bula, Judge Westbrook, and Judge Gibbons. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Johnson, and I represent the respondents, Orange Realty Group, LLC, and La Villa, LLC, in this matter. Your Honors, the respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order because the issues that are raised by the appellants were previously addressed in four prior cases, then the fifth case, and now you are here as the sixth set of the sixth court to determine these same issues that came from the same set of transaction and occurrences.
How are there five cases? There was an eviction action, there was a small claims action,
there was an eviction action.
Where are the other two coming from?
So there was an eviction action first, it was right, and I'll get into what happened in the eviction action. Second was the first appeal of the eviction action. That was
but that's
heard.
Still the same eviction action.
It is, but it's another court that's determining whether or not the eviction court did the right thing or not. That appeal got dismissed, and I'll go into more detail on that in just a moment. Then there was the second appeal of that, which was dismissed because it was untimely. And then there was the small claims action. And then the fifth action, or the fifth court to look at this, was the district court, and now you would be the sixth court to look at this.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
Is there any dispute that the respondent failed to follow the CHAP agreement and evicted prematurely?
I don't know the answer to that question. I have no idea. I did not represent the respondents at that stage of the game. I represented them coming in on the district court case.
Okay.
I went through, found all of the documents. There is nothing in the record that I can see that there was any money ever received. And in fact, during the arguments of counsel, she referenced this document 381 and says, well, you know, this is the document that shows that they got it. 381 does not say that at all. What 381 says, that's the landlord verification form. It looks like it was part of the CARES housing application. And what it says, I understand processing will only begin once the client or tenant has been approved for services. It says completion of this form does not guarantee client-tenant approval. And it says that I agree that not to initiate any legal proceedings or collection efforts against the tenants for unpaid rent, late fees, or other fees or charges relating to occupancy of the dwelling unit retroactive to March 1st through and until the present date or the end for the period for which rent is being paid, whichever is longer. Now, it's interesting because that document should not even be part of the record. That was actually filed. I didn't see that for the first time until after the notice of appeal had been filed. And as this court knows, you can't go in and try to supplement the record after you've already filed a notice of appeal and divested the court of jurisdiction. So that document, the only time that comes into the record is when the Washingtons went out after they'd already filed their notice of appeal, and they filed this with the court on July 19th, 2024. They filed their notice of appeal on July 8th, 2024. That's the only piece of evidence at all that I can see. And that doesn't say that they got any money. All it says is, hey, I understand that if we get money, then we're not supposed to evict. But there's no evidence in the record anywhere that says they got any money.
Mr. Johnson, is there any indication in the record? I mean, I think there was indication that money was given for a period of like 3 months. But was there an indication of what date that was paid? So I believe it was August, September, and October. There was an acknowledgement in the record indicating that funds were received.
Correct. In the first appeal and in the second appeal, the Washingtons made a statement, and I can point you to a document that I'm referring to, I believe. They made a statement that this is in their motion for reconsideration brought in the eviction action. It's AA000071. And what it says is, CHAP application was 11/30/2022, not 1/12/2023. And then it goes down, and it's harder to read, but it does say the landlord received a CHAP payment 11/7. So they alleged that there's an allegation that was at the in the motion for reconsideration stage in the first case in the eviction, that there was a CHAP payment received the 7th, but that the application wasn't made until the 30th. And if you look at the another document, which is the 7-3, that says that's a AA00073, and it says your application is waiting to be assigned to a caseworker, application date November 30th, 2022.
So, Mr. Johnson, let me ask this question.
Yes.
Whether or not the eviction was valid or proper, and there does seem to be a dispute there.
Yes.
Does it matter to us in resolving this appeal? How does it affect the resolution of this
appeal? The answer is it does not matter. And the reason why it does not matter, this case is not about whether she paid her rent, as counsel argued. It is not about whether she followed the procedural rules, as counsel argued. It's not about Nevada's laws regarding evictions either. What it is about is, did the procedural process, was it followed, and did it happen here? And the answer to that question is absolutely. If we look at the what happened, we had in the very first case, in the eviction case, there was a motion. They didn't file an answer timely, and it looks like they did try to do that. I'm not sure what happened. They apparently weren't able to file the I found in the record a reference where it said you can't use a CAM PDF. I'm assuming they were taking a picture on their cell phone. I don't know. But they did not file a timely answer in the eviction, and that's why the eviction proceeded. Had they done that, and they filed one, we wouldn't be here today. But there's a motion to set aside that was filed.
Why do you say we wouldn't be here today?
Because had they filed an answer, then there wouldn't be damages that they're claiming at all, because if they truly, in fact, did get paid, all of that would have come out of that time. I don't know whether they did or not. I wasn't involved in that process. Don't know. But at the end of the day, they did, after the eviction order was entered, they then filed a motion to set aside. That was done. They then filed a motion to reconsider. That was on January 23rd. That's 00071. They filed a motion to seal on March 6th, 2023. That's 00068. All of those were denied. They then filed an appeal. So court number two to look at this, 00059. That appeal was filed on May 8, 2023. The Justice Court said, yes, that's a timely filing, but they did not post a bond to stay the execution. That appeal was assigned to Judge Adrienne Escobar. She dismissed because there was no cost bond on file, which is required by the Justice Court rules. So they did not follow the procedural rules. Then they filed another appeal. The appellants filed appeal number two, third court now, May 24th, 2023. That's at 000135. They attached to that first appeal all of the documents attached to that second appeal, all the documents that were attached to the first appeal, which included the motion to set aside, the motion to reconsider, the motion to seal, and the attempt to file the responses. Judge Gall went through that. She issued a written opinion, which is found at 000295, and she found that, first of all, I can't accept evidence that was not part of evidence on the record below, which is what every appellate court has that obligation, and said, look, I can't accept evidence that was not raised below, and I also find that the appeal is untimely. So then it goes, that appeal then gets dismissed.
So I have a question for you. Did the Washingtons ever appeal from the January order, January 2022 order granting the summary eviction? Because that's a distinct order.
I am not certain of the answer to that question. I don't know if they did or did not.
Because those other appeals you reference are appealing from different orders.
Right. No, the first appeal was May 8th. The second appeal was May 24th. I am not sure if they were from different orders or not, because they were attached the same documents to each one of those. So I'm not certain of the answer to that question. I do know that they did, we're getting close on time, but I do know that they did file a complaint for damages in the small claims court after they went through the three different courts They then filed their complaint for damages. That's found it.
So, Mr. Johnson, looking at that complaint in small claims court, and then jumping ahead to the what you called the fifth court, the district court action.
Yes.
Can you address the question that's been deferred here for the moment? And
sure.
You won't have necessarily have another chance.
Yes.
Are there any claims that were filed in the district court that could not have been filed in the justice court?
No, absolutely not. Every single claim either was raised or could have been raised by the appellants in the small claims court. And the appellants chose the small claims court, by the way. They could have chosen, had they thought there wasn't a claim, they could have chosen to file it in the district court. But they made that choice to file it in the small claims court. That was not our decision. We had nothing to do with that.
But you're not challenging that their filing in the small claims court was improper,
No. Untimely. No.
You would agree that that was properly filed because arguably they didn't know what their damages would be.
Correct.
Until after the summary eviction was affirmed.
Correct. I think NRS 4253 subsection 6 does allow a tenant who believes that they're wrong to seek damages. Typically, what you see that for is something such as, hey, the landlord, they evicted me and then they took all my stuff and they threw it away. They didn't wait 30 days. They didn't give me the proper notice to come pick up my stuff. That's what it's typically for, but it doesn't limit it to that. And the fact of the matter is they did bring an action and they didn't appeal that action when they lost. That is where res judicata and claim preclusion comes in. They had that opportunity. They didn't appeal it. And the Supreme Court is very clear that just because you're a pro se person does not mean you don't have to follow the rules. You still are held to the same standards as if you're an attorney. You've got to, yes, we try to give deference, but at the end of the day, they have to follow those procedural rules. They did not. They filed their small claims action. That was adjudicated on the merits. They had a hearing that the hearing master went through. I believe it was 5 different documents, if I'm not mistaken. The hearing master went through all of those, ultimately found res judicata, claim preclusion and issue preclusion both applied, and dismissed the case with prejudice. What was their remedy? What they could have done is filed an appeal to that. They didn't do that. Instead, they waited 3 months and then filed another case in the district court, which is based on the exact same set of facts, same circumstances, and enough is enough. My clients are entitled to a decision and not keep dragging this out and more litigation. My clients didn't do anything wrong. They're alleging that they are these horrible, terrible people that are committing fraud. That's just not the case.
So would there be any exception that would apply here? In other words, if the small claims court had not been decided on the merits and there had been some sort of reservation, either in writing or it was just decided on the summary eviction. Now, would that still be on the merits, or if it wasn't on the merits, could they have brought the district court action?
I don't believe that they could have brought the district court action after they brought the action in small claims court. They decided which court to bring it in. They brought it in the small claims court. That judge went through everything, listened to them, held a hearing. It was a complete hearing on the merits. It's not like it was not on the merits. It was on the merits. And that decision was rendered. They didn't appeal it. That precluded them.
Would you agree that the summary eviction matter resolved the issue of whether the Washingtons could be lawfully evicted by their landlord?
I think that that was the issue, yes. And I think that could have been addressed and was addressed at the eviction stage when they filed their motion for reconsideration, when they filed their motion to seal the case, when they filed the motion to set aside the summary eviction order. All 3 of those orders were considered on the merits. They were denied. There was an appeal, but they didn't follow the process. And there was a second appeal, and again, was dismissed because they didn't do it timely. And look, you know, there's a lot of allegations here that are not on the record. The couch surfing allegations, the allegations that they're homeless for all this time. None of that's on the record. It shouldn't even be brought up. And I would object to that. But at the end of the day, issue preclusion and claim preclusion both apply here.
Did you ever expressly argue issue preclusion in your briefing below? The court reached the issue, but I don't remember seeing that particular argument made below. So
I don't recall, but I do know that the same claims were brought in the small claims action, were brought in this action. And if there was something that was missed, it should have been brought. I think we raised in the lower court that, hey, it should have been brought as a compulsory claim, and ultimately the court found that issue preclusion and claim preclusion applied and denied and dismissed the
case. And you believe claims preclusion resolves this issue?
Yes.
We don't need to reach issue preclusion.
I think you're correct. Yes, sir. Any questions? I think I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
Ms. McFarland.
Good morning. There are a lot of questions that I have been writing notes to address, so hopefully I can get through those in my short amount of time. The issue of claim preclusion of the small claims case was not argued below, and it was not the basis for the dismissal. And so that, I realize that that is this huge issue in this case, but it is not the basis for the decision in this case, and it wasn't the argument that was made there. And so that in itself gives you a reason that you can, address the small claims issue, not need to address the small claims issue as the main basis in this appeal. There was a question by Judge Westbrook, did the small claims action give appellants the opportunity, and was it a final decision on the merits? Yes, it was a final decision on the merits of the claims that were brought there. And when you look at every single little piece of this case, that certainly jumps out as a potential problem in it. But we have, even if that's something you really want to hang your hat on, and I'm going to get to the bigger picture in a minute, that action had a 10,000 limit. The complaint in that action only asked for 10,000 in damages. The preclusion should only be limited to that amount. It was filed before many damages came later on. It should only be precluded for anything prior to the filing of the complaint in that case. There's requests in the district court case that were not in the small claims action. In fact, the specific requests in the complaint having to do with the damages to her credit, the damages to the eviction on the record, and very specific claims for damages that are in the complaint were not brought in the small claims action. And the reality is that the district court is best suited to decide what could possibly be precluded in here. So on that issue, I would ask that if you do think there's potentially something precluded by the small claims action, that when you reverse and remand the case, that you give direction for that to be determined based on the specific facts of what was actually requested, what were the claims brought in the small claims action, so that it's not just a blanket preclusion, but very specific direction for that issue to be sorted out. Now let's get to the bigger issue, though. I mean, we've heard these arguments of, there was evidence that was brought in that was just referenced by Respondents' Counsel that...
Ms. McFarland, you are out of time. I've let you go 1 minute over. I'm going to give you another minute.
Another minute. Okay. Oh. Okay. So the error of dismissing the case means that there was no evidence considered. And there is evidence in this case that would have resulted in my client being awarded damages, and she should have been given that opportunity in order for that evidence to be presented. And so just giving one example of one document that proves, I think is, certainly something that shows the extent of that error. Respondents' counsel was asked whether or not appellant's paid rent made a difference in this case. Yes, it makes a difference. The fact that this woman, these people were receiving COVID relief, there was a signed agreement that said that they would not proceed with any eviction for 60 days. And during those 60 days, they did proceed with an eviction. That certainly matters because when we look at the entirety of this case, every single step of the way, these women were told no, 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 when the reality is they should not have been evicted in the first place. And so for this court to say, well, you missed a step here representing yourself in these over and over and over again, they keep trying to say, hey, you messed up. You didn't listen to me. And we're here today and you have the opportunity to listen to them and to correct the wrongs that happened at every single step in this path that they've been taking. All they really want is their day in court and to be heard and to have somebody actually consider all the evidence on their claims for what really was wrongdoing by the respondents in filing the eviction in the first place.
Thank you, Ms. McFarland. Well, thank you.